from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
Daddy finally intervened. "Let her alone, Mama. She doesn't have to eat it," he said. I knew he had just stepped into the fire for me.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
It wasn't until I was picked up at the high school by relatives who lived out of town that I realized that something was wrong. I knew my dad was sick. I knew he was dying. But I didn't comprehend that this was his last trip to the hospital.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
Dad let the deafening silence sink in and then said, "I don't care what dinner tastes like. I want you boys to let on like it's the best meal you've ever eaten."
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
And tonight's so lonely. Sit you lay with me here all alone. You come back. Stay gone, it'll be my fault. Sweetheart of mine, can't you hear me calling? A million times I love you, babe. I mistreated you, little girl, and I'm sorry. Back to me in my request. Oh, the days are dark and the nights are lonely since you left me here all alone. You come back. Stay gone, it'll be my fault. Sweetheart of mine, can't you hear me calling? A million times I love you, babe. I mistreated you, little girl, and I'm sorry. Back to me is my request. Come back to me is my request. Come back to me is my request.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week is our 6th annual Father's Show, where our writers show us the many different facets of fatherhood. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Sandra spots Hamilton's dad sticks out his neck for her at the dinner table. And we'll end the night with Philip Taylor as he enters his father's hospital room for the last time. But let's start the night with James Sewell as his father asks him to do something he never imagined he would in Soul Food.
Dad pulled the silver 1986 Lincoln Continental, a tad pretentious looking back, into my grandparents' driveway. But he was yet to put the car in park before my mom leaned over and whispered in his ear. My mother was a more experienced and better qualified in-car lecturer, so it was somewhat of a surprise that I now saw my preacher father poised to give a speech. We braced for the rare non-pulpit sermon that I assumed would be some version of "Thou shalt not argue around Grandma," what with her being sick and all. My brother, a born troublemaker, would have no doubt needed this lecture, but today's spiel had more of a solemn tone. Dad shifted his focus from Mom to the back seat as he looked into the rearview mirror and addressed us. We were instructed to lie. Chester, thank God he was born and thus named first, and I turned and slowly looked at each other, if for no other reason than to simply check our hearing. Dad let the deafening silence sink in and then said, "I don't care what dinner tastes like, I want you boys to let on like it's the best meal you've ever eaten." And in that moment, I realized that there are certain things of which even the children of Church of Christ preachers must lie. And if my preacher dad and Sunday school teaching mom were asking me to lie, then times were desperate. My stomach turned and I was startled to have to brace myself not to cry. 1,000 thoughts raced through my mind in between our car and my grandparents' front door. I had heard and tried to dismiss the whispered rumors within the family about Grandma Vival, that she was trying to die. General consensus in the family was that the prognosis was probably not lethal, but that Grandma Vival was as stubborn as a Democratic donkey, and once she had announced that she might die, we had no choice but to take her seriously. The fate of her life and a normal childhood for my brother and I hinged on the word might. Grandma, as we say in the Ozarks, was a ringtail tutor. She could tell off a grown person without thinking twice. Rural Christian women in the South tell off instead of cuss out, which they leave for Yankees, city folks, and white trash. Despite her temper and aptitude to verbally harangue those in need, to her grandchildren, she was the personification of unconditional love. Having not seen Grandma since her dismissal from St. Bernard's in Jonesboro, we entered her living room with trepidation. Entering the front room, we noticed that Grandma's velvet green rocking recliner had been replaced with a hospital bed too big for the room. We cautiously rounded the corner past the grandfather clock she had won from selling boatloads of Avon. Before we could get to the kitchen, we heard her quarreling with our saintly grandfather. "Well, I swear, Quim, you're just as slow as molasses." Her rancor faded quickly when she saw my brother and me. Our much thinner grandma bade us welcome and insisted on hugging our necks. After we had allowed Grandma to love all over each of us, including her patting our backs and saying to both of us, "God bless your little bones," my brother and I disappeared into the living room. Neither of us commented on her changed appearance, but Grandma looked more normal, more Grandma, fat. My brother and I raced to the television, a huge old faux wood grain Magnavox, to slide the dial on the top of the box of the TV. A privilege of living in the town of Maynard, our grandparents had cable, which was a real treat to the pair of us one-channel-only brothers from out on rural Route 5. We barely escaped a quarrel by receiving the hint of our mother's clear throat, and we would have surely fought over which of the 13 channels to land, but we were called to the dining room. Grandma summons us to the dinner table with her standard, "Y'all come on, this little nasty bite is ready." Heretofore, this little nasty bite line had always been a lie, a rural Southern lady criticizing her own cooking as an invitation for those present to disagree with her. False humility is another form of acceptable truth stretching in the fundamentalist backwoods of Northeast Arkansas. This verbal sparring is one form of dancing of which we are not opposed. Grandma instructed, "Quam, turn thanks," to our church elder grandpa, who didn't miss a beat. He offered the same pre-meal blessing verbatim, as always, whereby he beseeched the Lord to forgive our many sins and ask him to bless this table of refreshments before closing it in the standard King James. In thy name, amen. Grandma manned the dumpling bowl and lopped great ladles full of them onto our plates, starting with me as the youngest. Usually Grandma's dumplings were delicious, but these excuses for dumplings were thick, lumpy balls of flour soaked in chicken grease. I tried hard not to stare at them as various fried foods and garden veggies were passed around the table and the adults talked church gossip and local politics. Did y'all hear about that Blancett boy? His grandpa would roll over in his grave. Wasn't it awful about old Peggy Parsons? But I can't say it didn't serve her right. Reckon if the catfish are biting down on the blue hole on Mud Creek, I may found out, good Lord willing, and a creek don't rise. Granny, pass them black-eyed peas. Dad, realizing that little had been said about the meal, lied heartily. Ma, you got a good scald on the dumplings. Grandpa, taking his turn, but not one apt to lie, offered, yes, they're very filling. Grandma, for once, missed the insult as the rest of us took our turns lying. Then, after receiving Mom's glance, serving as an equivalent of a twisted ear into compliance, we even insisted on seconds. Grandma gladly obliged, and then announced, well, y'all eat up. These may be the last dumplings I ever make. I may not be long for this earth. I could not imagine a world without Grandma Vival, much less without chicken and dumplings. Thankful for once to have parental approval and even our dad's insistence to lie, my brother and I kicked our compliments into overdrive. In fact, this was the first time in our entire lives of dumplings once a week that we had ever felt a need to lie, at least about Grandma's cooking. Grandma stared at us and studied our faces. We weren't sure if she discerned that our statements of praise were well-intentioned lies. Grandma was no fool, but neither were Chester and I a bad pair of liars. I could feel Dad staring at us, but I never looked his way. Grandma either appreciated the gesture or believed our every word because she invited us to Sunday dinner on the spot. The next Sunday, we found ourselves at the same dinner table, but this time with no need to lie. The chicken and dumplings that Sunday were divine. It turns out that Grandma did not decide to die, not then. She lived another decade or so after that scare on into the new millennium, just long enough to see her beloved Bill Clinton out of office and her youngest grandchild graduate from college. There's a reason good Southern food is called soul food. Grandma finally cooked her last pot of chicken and dumplings on earth, though I like to think she's in heaven cooking dumplings for her Lord. And Dad, well, even though Chester and I got a few more non-pulpit sermons over the years, Dad never again asked us to lie, at least not directly. Though in matters of dating or dealing with the opposite sex, he has been known to say that there are certain situations where no gentleman would ever stoop so low as to tell the truth.
James Sewell, now a clinical social worker in Little Rock area schools, was born and raised and born again in the foothills of the Arkansas Ozarks, where he grew up eating his grandmother's chicken and dumplings. In our next story, Sandra spots Hamilton crosses a line and her father crosses with her in The Rabbit.
You're going to eat this rabbit or you will never get up from that chair, Mama growled as she glared at me across the table. Tears began to roll down my cheeks and splash onto the mound of mashed potatoes like rain on a volcano. The tears only heightened her anger. Eat it, eat it, eat it, she demanded. Sister sat stunned, dropping her eyes to her plate. I thought of the pet white bunnies I'd seen in cages behind Mr. Mack's house. The curiously tall Easter bunny that gave out free samples of chocolate eggs at the Blast department store candy counter, and those darting, life-filled swampers and cottontails we had seen in the woods the day before. Daddy finally intervened. Let her alone, Mama. She doesn't have to eat it, he said. I knew he had just stepped into the fire for me. I could feel him looking at me knowingly as we waited for the explosion. That Sunday had started off with the usual routine of church, a lunch of leftovers, and my parents quarreling. It could be about money, or who had taken on more responsibilities, or whose fault something was 10 or 12 years ago. But most likely, it would be about all of that. Doors were slammed, and newspapers were thrown on the floor as epithets flew through the air. Dad had taken us girls the day before down around Stuttgart for a hunt and a respite from the marital issues of the week. I didn't like the hunting part as much as I liked being side by side with Daddy to watch him enjoy being in the woods. Every now and then, he would point over to the creek towards some wood ducks or down at deer tracks along the muddy bank. It was not long before Zorro, our family beagle, had jumped the trail of a cottontail or a swamp rabbit. He was a tenacious hunter, a quality admired by Daddy, who thought all dogs, family pet or not, should earn their keep. Before long, Zorro and Daddy had bagged two rabbits, both cottontails. Since Sister was the older of us and therefore taller, she had the task of carrying the dead rabbits by the ears. I walked slightly behind, watching the lifeless, still warm bodies dangle and bounce with every step. Sister carried her burden with her lips tightened and eyes only focused forward, never straying down. I followed the stream of blood from their mouths to the drops left behind on the clumpy dirt road. When we got home, Dad skinned and dressed the rabbits. I watched every now and then, curious to see what was under the fur. I was intrigued by the pinkish skin with purple veining, but then the putrid smell of warm blood forced me off the chair I'd pulled up by his work table under the back porch. I went into the house to play with my dolls and thought about the cottontails and swampers Daddy identified as they raced by us in the woods and how fast they were, except for two of them. I picked up my blue plush bunny, turning him over and over, trying to figure out just how this toy was like and not like the rabbits we had seen in the woods. I straightened the bow under his chin and put him on my side of the bed Sister and I shared. The day had faded into evening and the call to supper came. As I slowly walked into the kitchen, I reluctantly surveyed the table for the evening's offerings. Mashed potatoes, gravy, English peas, lettuce and tomato salad. Then, there it was. Something that looked like fried chicken, but with distorted parts. I slowly climbed in my chair and filled my plate with potatoes, peas, and salad and began to eat. Mother, still in a state of agitation from the earlier quarrels with Daddy, stood over me with a hand on hip and a deep scowl. Get some rabbit. You don't have any rabbit on that plate. It's good. No, thank you. What do you mean, no? I said get some rabbit. I don't want any rabbit, Mama, I mumbled. Her voice became shrill and loud, and her small frame began to shake. She jabbed a fork into a leg piece and jammed it on my plate, insisted that I had to eat it, and threatened that I would not get up from my chair until it was all gone. And that's when Daddy took up for me and put himself square in the middle of the battle. Mama's ire rose. She does have to eat it, too. She's never had to do anything in her life. This is what I spent my time fixing for supper, and she's going to eat it, she screamed across the kitchen. There's no reason she can't eat that rabbit same as you and me. Daddy quietly and slowly replied, she's only 8 years old, Mama. She's barely had a life. It won't matter if she eats that rabbit or not. It will too matter. It matters to me, she screamed, throwing the wadded up dish towel toward Daddy's head. Daddy then tried diplomacy. Shorty, why don't you go on and take a little bite? I could see that there would be no other way to get out of this standoff or away from this table ever. I sat up in my chair, looked at Daddy as if he were a turncoat. I tore off a piece of the meat with my fork. As I raised it to my mouth, Mama was distracted by the stove burner she had left on, giving me enough time to bury the meat under the mashed potato volcano as I feigned chewing. She sat at the table, pushing back a lock of her jet black hair. Now, see, there was no need for you to be so stubborn, was there? It's good, isn't it? She settled into her chair and calmly filled her plate. Again, I could feel Daddy looking at me, and I knew he'd never tell. Yes, ma'am, I said, still chewing on air. During my lifetime, I've thought about the rabbits, the racing swampers and cottontails, the Easter bunny at blast, and especially the fried one on that platter. I've also thought a lot about Daddy, first focusing on how he gave in to Mama's orders. Then later, after people and even life itself bullying me with meanness, broken marriage, cancer, and the loss of a young one, how he stood up for me that day, tried to soften the blows as best he could, and I realized that when it's all said and done, Daddy showed me that I could find my own way to eat, or if I chose, feign eating the rabbit. That standing down isn't the same thing as losing. And thanks to Daddy, that's not so hard to swallow anymore.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton is a writer and designer who is a native of Little Rock, Arkansas. She graduated from the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville with a degree in art and a minor in English. In our final story of the night, Philip Taylor shares a moment with his father he'll never forget in Room with a View.
I remember it being very warm that afternoon of May 22, 1992. Me and about 20 other people who crammed into my father's hospital room on the 10th floor, the cancer floor, of Baptist Hospital in Little Rock. Just that morning, I had taken my final exams for my junior year at Malvern High School and went on with my usual business. It wasn't until I was picked up at the high school by relatives who lived out of town that I realized that something was wrong. I knew my dad was sick. I knew he was dying. But I didn't comprehend that this was his last trip to the hospital. In my immaturity, I did not equate that a frail shell of a man being wheeled out of his house on a gurney meant that he would never return home. I thought maybe that my mom just could no longer take care of him and he was being moved to the hospital to be treated until he recovered to a state where he would someday return home. Nobody spoke of him dying at the time he was taken away. Nobody wanted to say those words. Somehow, we're able to muster the strength to watch someone wilt and fade, but it's nearly impossible to talk about it. It's too hard. It's too painful. I stepped off the elevator and onto the 10th floor of Baptist Hospital, walked down the long, quiet hallway, and opened the door. You see on shows on TV where a man is dying and there is one woman quietly weeping at his bedside as a song by The Fray softly plays in the background. But that was not the scenario for my father's passing at all. It was shoulder to shoulder, standing room only. These people weren't crammed into a small hospital room to watch a man die. They were there to pay their greatest respect to a man who loved and adored them. And they were now saying goodbye to my father by showing their love and adoration to him on this, his final day. Close family was there. My mother and brother were there. Many of my aunts and uncles were there. Cousins, friends. My father knew no strangers. Everyone he came into contact with was sure to remember him. He had a Cheshire smile and a laugh that resonated throughout a room and would reach deep down into your soul. Of course, many of us hold our parents in the highest regard, but my father truly was special. He played with all of the children in the neighborhood and was like a foster father to those who didn't have caring, compassionate dads. At the time, I didn't realize just how special that was. He was just daddy to me. I thought that all daddies played with their kids and showed a sincere interest in their activities. I thought all daddies hugged their children each night and told them that they loved them. I thought all daddies were warm, compassionate, and caring. It wasn't until I was much older that I realized that not everyone was fortunate enough, as I was, to have grown up with the man who raised me. I stepped inside the room and joined them. Although my father was dying, he was quite awake for a man who had one foot on this planet and the other foot in another realm. I could tell from the look in his eyes that he was very pleased that so many people had come to pay great respect to him. My father had grown so weak that the words he muttered were inaudible, but that didn't keep him from speaking. He had something special to say to many of us in the room. We knelt down and put our ears to his thin lips as he gave us each instructions on what we were to do after his passing. I don't remember what he told my mother and brother, but I clearly remember what he said to me, as if I had just heard it this morning. "Take care of your mother and brother," my dad whispered with one of his last breaths. "I will. I said, with all the strength the teenager could possibly have, as I was watching the man I admired most in this world fade away. I hugged him gently and stood up. Then Dad looked over at the window and muttered something that we all thought was incoherent. But someone, possibly my mother, leaned in and caught what he was saying. "Snow?" she asked, as if she didn't hear him correctly. She then turned to the crowd and said, "He says it's snowing." Now, in case you didn't know, it hardly snows in Arkansas but once or twice every couple of years, let alone in late May. But that was not enough to stop our logical thinking minds from turning us around. Everyone silently turned simultaneously toward the window. Slowly, almost as if we didn't want to see that it wasn't snowing. After all, they did not want to indirectly call a dying man a liar. Everyone gazed out of the large picture window on the 10th floor of Baptist Hospital. Nobody said a word. We just stood, staring into space. Some of us contemplated our existence, while others of us stared into the fair blue sky and took a moment to breathe. But the silence was soon broken with an abrupt exclamation. "Heaven!" an older lady in the group exclaimed. "Robert sees heaven! He sees heaven! Heaven!" The shouting of the woman didn't startle the crowd. In fact, everyone seemed to concentrate harder, staring out of the large gaping window in an effort to see if we could catch a glimmer of the pearly gates. I don't know how long we stood there. Could have been minutes, could have been hours. What I do know is that we were all looking at that same fair blue sky. To this day, nobody who was in that room has ever spoken a word about our encounter in the cancer ward on that clear, late spring day. But there is one thing that I do know for sure. That's the closest we all have ever been to heaven, and will be, until we, like my dad, one day watch it snow in May.
Philip Taylor is an author, musician, and university instructor from Malvern, Arkansas. Today, on the 20th anniversary of his father's passing, Philip wanted to share this story in tribute to Robert's life and influence. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.